Welcome to the On Your Mind podcast, where we are changing the mental health narrative, bringing hope and solutions. Here's your host, Timothy J. Hayes, psychologist.
Winfred Doerr is the founder and CEO of Zing Performance. Winfred is a successful entrepreneur and has been the founder of many successful companies and the creator of countless forward-looking innovative solutions. For the last 20 years, Winfred has focused his attention on changing the world one brain at a time through Zing Performance. Winfred funds many research projects and works with leading academics to determine the best solutions that successfully accelerate learning in the brain. Winfred, thank you so much for joining us here this morning.
Oh, my pleasure to be with you, Dr. Tim.
I was hoping you could start us off by letting us know a little bit about how you got into the work you do and what drives your passion for it.
I got into this because I'm one of these off-the-wall researchers, and the industries I was in, I kind of turned them upside down, not because I was trying to, but because I was asking the questions and coming up with...
I am pleased to announce that I will be participating in the upcoming Integrative Mental Health Summit. I'm honored to be speaking alongside 35 of the most innovative thought leaders and practitioners in the mental health field today. The three-day virtual event will take place October 8th through 10th, 2021. It is sure to be packed with inspiration, education, tools, and support. You can get your pass today to attend the entire summit for a minimum donation of only $25. At integrativementalhealthsummit.org. That's integrativementalhealthsummit, all one word, .org. Please join us for this fabulous event and share this information with anybody that you think might benefit.
Ideas that others seem to have avoided. But then after I've been doing that for quite a time, they were very successful. My daughter got more and more depressed. She'd been struggling at school very badly. I got four wonderful kids, and all were the same teachers, same school, but one of them didn't learn and three of them did. And her mental health was in decline more and more. And finally, she attempted suicide. And through God's mercy, she lived. But that changed my life because I realized all of the things that I'd been working on was kind of meaningless when you've got a daughter that's seriously depressed. So I sold my businesses, took me a bit of a time, and then I came across the research that pointed me off in a certain direction. And that's how I started. And as soon as I went on that track, I realized that there were countless families, probably as much as one in four families, affected with a child that struggles. And unless you deal with the root cause of that, that child becomes an adult who probably adapts their life to a certain extent to avoid the things that are really difficult, but they still go through life underachieving, unfulfilled, and often troubled with the high chance of increasing mental health problems. So I keep bumping into these people, Tim, and that keeps motivating me because when I see them improve, that's kind of like the most precious thing you can do in life is to watch someone's life, quality of life improve, especially if it's in a way they never thought possible. So that's why I started, and that's why my job isn't finished by a long, long way, and why I'm still passionate to this day.
Wonderful. So tell us a little bit about what you began to discover and what you've developed. What's being offered at Zing Performance?
Well, one of the first things I discovered was that there were many symptoms associated with learning difficulties with mental health. Usually there was one very significant symptom. It could be they couldn't read or they couldn't pay attention or their behavior was bad or they were constantly anxious. But there's always one particular symptom that's up there front and center, but there's always loads more symptoms. And I bumped into a guy actually from New York who was researching this, and he started talking about a bit of the brain called the cerebellum. And he was saying it's different to what people think. He didn't want to work with me as by way of research. I wanted what he was doing to spread worldwide. So I took it on myself to find the best professors who are at cutting edge in understanding the role of this bit of the brain called the cerebellum. And what has been understood about the cerebellum up until very recent years was that it's coordinating balance and gross motor skills, and that's its job. But a few professors were saying, oh no, that's just a small part of its job. It's actually the master junction box to coordinate everything that happens in our brain, not just our physical movements, but our cognitive functions and emotional controls and so on. And when I started looking into the cerebellum and delving into the latest stuff that was coming out, I found that I was able to understand for the first time, not just the main symptom that my daughter Susie had, but all of the symptoms, the poor emotional control, the lack of organization, the poor short-term memory sometimes, and so on and so on, the low self-esteem. There were a whole range of symptoms that were in some sort of box that applied to her. And I found that every other child or adult had a range of symptoms, may have only been focusing on one. But so this breakthrough of understanding exactly what the cerebellum was doing gave me a massive aha moment. For the first time, I was able to understand this whole plethora of symptoms that affect children that struggle in school, adults that struggle with learning and attention.
So what did you discover is the role of the cerebellum in that plethora of problems?
Well, there's two stages to this part of the discussion. The first stage that the cerebellum does is it either makes us a natural at things or not. So when we're a natural, be it a golf or reading or math or art or whatever it is, when we're a natural, it's because the cerebellum has done the job of creating really fully developed skills that enables us to perform that skill without thinking about it. So that's the first thing. So for instance, reading, which is an issue for about 1 in 4 people of all ages, reading is actually a combination of skills, but one of the most important that's often not fully developed is eye movement. And the videos we now provide people to show this is what's happening with your eye movement explains it immediately why reading for them is very hard work. So eye movement, smooth eye movement, so that it follows the letters and words properly and accurately, is a skill. It's either fully developed by the cerebellum or it's not fully developed. And when it's not fully developed, it's pretty catastrophic, because not only do the eyes have to take in letters and words that aren't smooth, so that gives the brain already a huge job to unscramble them. But whenever a skill is not fully developed, like eye movement, which we're just focusing on, then the thinking brain has to be very involved to make up for the fact that there isn't a hardwired skill. So we can understand this when we're learning to ride a bike, drive a car, learning to socialize for the first time or speak on stage, whatever it is we're learning, fly a helicopter if you want, whatever it is we're learning, we are thinking very hard. And it's the cerebellum that turns those thoughts that we're thinking to try and carry out this skill into a process that we don't need to think about. So that's the role of the cerebellum. It's integral to the learning process. And some wonderful stuff now being shown to explain to us exactly how the cerebellum does. That's really exciting to explore. But effectively, it's turning thoughts into subconscious processes that we don't have to think about. So whenever we've got a skill that we use all the time, and eye tracking is just one example, we can talk about a few more in a minute, but just taking eye tracking, if you're trying to read and every time you try and read, your thinking brain is full of just trying to control your eyes because the cerebellum hasn't finished its job. Your thinking brain goes into overload. It's doing stuff it shouldn't have to do. Now, the problem with that is the thinking brain, it's the only bit of the brain we can access. So it's where we recall things. It's where we make lists. It's where we think things through. It's where we make decisions. And when this is full of helping out with skills that aren't fully developed, they call it conscious compensation. So whenever underdeveloped skills are being used, our thinking brain is full of stuff that shouldn't be there. But that's where our executive function is. So it's this bit of the brain that determines what and whether we can pay attention. It's this bit of the brain that helps us make decisions and avoid impulsivity, stops us making bad decisions. It's this bit of the brain that helps us think things through so that when we start to worry about something, we can either put it in perspective, come up with a plan, rationalize it, and feel okay about it. Or if we haven't got much space, we can't put it in perspective. We can't think it through. We haven't got the space to. So we end up being overwhelmed by it. So the anxiety that comes as one of the symptoms of this plethora of conditions that I believe leads to mental fragility can be explained by whether or not the cerebellum is making everyday key skills fully developed so that they're natural or not. Is that making a bit of sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And as I listen to you, I remember that when I was in high school and college and trying to play baseball or softball, they called me scatterarm. And I was a very daydreamy kind of a person. And if I was absolutely focused on the movement and when I released the ball, I could be right on target.
Wow.
Right? A nice arm and straight on target. But most of the time, I was thinking about four other things, and then which base do I throw it to? And then I'd make a last minute decision to throw it, and it would go errant. And that makes really good sense of what you're talking about, because I couldn't figure out why sometimes I would throw it right where it needed to be. And I didn't have any physical maladies that would explain the ball going in all these different places. But what you just described makes excellent sense.
So just to highlight it, so when someone is learning to ride a bike, they know what to do. They've watched it. They've been told. They're thinking about it, but they're falling off. It's only when the cerebellum has done the job of turning all of those thoughts into a hardwired process that the brain can perform automatically without thought, are you able to ride a bike? Now, one of the things that there's a couple of facts I'll just throw in here. First of all, the cerebellum is only 10% by volume of the whole brain, but it's 75% of all our brain cells. Wow. It is the critical junction box that makes all the connections between different parts of the brain and between brain and body. So that statistic only came out a few years ago from Harvard Medical School. And that was a huge eye-opener. So everyone that's been, you know, when they do fMRI studies, they often cut off the cerebellum. Oh, we know what that does. Oh, no, we don't. It's far more important. So the cerebellum is incredibly important, and it is the master junction box. But the second thing is just to understand why having fully developed skills and processes is important is the thinking brain can only hold about seven things. And as you get older, that becomes six and becomes five and so on. Whereas the cortex, it's almost unlimited in terms of capacity. So the ease with which we become overwhelmed, go into overload, is determined by how much is happening in the thinking brain that shouldn't be happening there. The other fact I just want to throw in right early on here is that the speed of processing here in the prefrontal cortex, where you have to process if you're struggling with any underdeveloped skill, the speed of processing here is between 40,000 times slower and a million times slower than processing in the cortex, which is why when you're learning to ride a bike, before your brain has worked out how far to lean over, you've fallen off. It's only the subconscious that's processing fast enough to deal with those skills. Learning to ride a bike is kind of an extreme example, but it applies to all sorts of things.
Before you go on to that, let me ask you to restate the statistic about what percentage of cells in the brain are in the cerebellum compared to the size of it.
Research from Harvard Medical School says that the cerebellum is only 10% by volume of the whole of the brain, yet it's 75%, three quarters of all of our brain cells. That kind of highlights just how important the cerebellum is. And that's only come out in recent. It's not that that word isn't spreading, but it's there in the literature. You can look it up. It's a really important thing to focus on, because if there was more focus on the cerebellum, we'd be making far more progress in understanding the root cause of all sorts of mental health issues that exist today.
Wow.
The other example, which is really common, Dr. Tim, is auditory processing. In other words, listening. You know, it's a joke when people can't listen, but it's not a joke, really. What we call attention deficit, you know, if it's bad enough, we'll label a lot of people ADHD, and then we'll give them some drugs to help them cope with that. But what we're talking about for a large proportion of them is the very basic brain skill of turning sound waves that go into your ears into thoughts you can comprehend. If that's not working properly, we can often cruelly say, you can see his cogs whirring. What we're saying is the automatic process to turn sound waves to comprehended thoughts isn't there. So the poor folk that have to experience that, they're having to work incredibly hard listening. So, you know, I've run a school for many years in England. And when I get a chance, I tell the teachers, you know, a child that is struggling with attention is not choosing to not pay attention. They're having to work literally hundreds of times harder than others, turning what those sound waves into comprehended thoughts. And as a result, they get exhausted. So it's not a choice, and they get exhausted, and then they get blamed for not paying attention as if it's a choice. So understanding what's happening in the cerebellum and the fact that if we're wired to be a certain way, we are wired to be a certain way. And that needs understanding. Teachers, parents, friends, colleagues, family all need to understand this is how you're wired. And we can come on to in a while, what can you do about it, which is another exciting piece of the story. But start off by understanding what causes us to be a natural or not a natural at all of the key skills that we need. But you touched on playing sport. I was never very good at sport, and I now know why. I now know what I should have done about it, but I didn't. But any limitation in sport, any limitation, whatever it is, can be explained by the cerebellum not having finished its job.
So when you say finished its job, it may not have the capacity it's not automatically coding those repetitive responses. So then I have to rely on the conscious thought process to go through it.
Yeah, well, the stages of learning are we think and we can't do it very well. Then the process starts, the cerebellum starts. So you get like a conscious competence where there's a bit of automaticity, but you're still having to think. Then finally, when it's developed fully, you get the unconscious competence. And that's when the cerebellum has finished its job. There's no need for conscious thought. And the cortex is able to do the whole thing. That's when we're in the zone. And that's a completed skill or process that the cerebellum has done properly. Now, there's different parts of the cerebellum. As we know, it's 3/4 of all brain cells. It's lots of little rooms in there. And it's like different computer coders that look after different types of skill. So when we think of someone that's a natural at drawing an art, it's because that part of the cerebellum has developed all of the skills to make that effortless and automatic. And if I'm not so good at art, it's because that bit of the cerebellum isn't so good at that. And likewise for music or dance or math or whatever process it is, the different parts of the cerebellum, and they've actually done the work now to identify physically which part of the cerebellum is responsible for which type of skill. So when you understand the cerebellum, you can start to predict people's behaviors, people's strengths, people's weaknesses, and so on.
So then I can hear people listening to this chomping at the bit saying, okay, then what do I do about it? What if I recognize that my cerebellum is not very efficient, let's say? Now what?
Well, that has also come out in recent years. The implications are enormous for society, for mankind, the implications at the human level, the individual level, the implications are huge. So going back to the beginning, my daughter has attempted to take her life. The experts that I took her to see were all saying she's got to learn to live with her problems. And I'm saying, hang on a second, she's just attempted to take her life. She's announced to the world, with these problems, it ain't worth living.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine my passion and focus and obsession, and it's never stopped. But it meant that I was able to try out more things than would normally be allowed. I was able to go bonkers. I had to go bonkers. I had to go nuts. So I ended up recruiting in total, I think there were about 400 staff working on this project, a lot of doctors, a lot of physiotherapists. And what we were looking for was how to force the development of the cerebellum so that it did its job better. What I wanted was a natural solution. I didn't want to use medication. I wanted to find what was the brain not doing right and could we change the brain so it did it right. And a professor from Sheffield, Professor Rod Nicholson, he's still my mentor to this day, he pointed me down the track of looking for combinations of exercises that might stimulate the cerebellum and permanently change it. So we worked with 45,000 different people, all of whom had reading and or attention issues of all ages, mainly children, but a lot of adults as well. And we had this 400 staff. There were 57 clinics involved in this process, which I was leading and driving. And it wasn't long before we realized, you know, we had a huge amount of data, so it was very, the responses were quick. It wasn't long before we realized that when we combine something that excites the vestibular system at the same time as challenging the cerebellum, so that's two different types of exercise. One was a challenging balance-related exercise, and vestibular stimulation can be literally balance or rotation or vertical movement, lateral movement, any form of movement that's a bit bolder than you would normally do in everyday life. So in other words, you're stressing the vestibular system, the balance organ a bit. Do that at the same time as you're challenging the cerebellum. Put those two together. They look like exercises. They were actually stimulating plasticity. That's what we were setting out to do. And sure enough, we were, because when we did that for just 10 minutes twice a day at the time, we just do it once a day now, but 10 minutes twice a day, it created the plasticity and created the challenge so that it was like doing an audit on the sensory integration in that the cerebellum had completed. And we were plugging the gaps systematically. And it, all of those gaps in sensory integration were effectively like little pieces of jigsaw. And when we need to develop a new skill, the brain looks for these pieces of jigsaw and puts them together to form a new skill. So if you go back to riding a bike, there's an awful lot of things about balance and movement and leg movement and leaning over and visual processing and spatial awareness. There's a whole number of skills, and they're actually all little pieces of jigsaw, sensory integration jigsaw. And if the brain has got them all, the cerebellum can turn it into a proper automatized process that means we can effortlessly ride the bike. But if any one or more of those small pieces of sensory integration have never been finished off, then there's going to be a gap. And that gap is going to have to be compensated for in the thinking brain. Is that making some sense?
Absolutely. And I'm wondering what kinds of things or are exercises that you're referring to challenge the cerebellum?
It's amazing. We've got literally hundreds and hundreds of different exercises. So when we go about trying to help someone, we start off with neurological tests. We want to find out their working memory capacity is, what their working memory processing speed is, and the same for visual memory, working memory capacity, visual processing speed, memory recall abilities. We've got a whole plethora of skills that we're, brain skills that we're measuring. From that, we can determine the right type of vestibular challenge, the right degree of vestibular stimulation, and the right type of cerebellar challenge that we do. So we do a huge amount of neurological testing before we prescribe what exercises should you do today. Then every day we get feedback and we adjust the level and type of integration, the type of challenge for the cerebellum. And we're keeping on pushing up all of those, the development of those skills. But what we're actually doing is we're creating plasticity, and the plasticity is actually increases density of gray matter. And that was a wonderful piece of research to come out showing that we're increasing the density of gray matter in key parts of the cerebellum. And then nature produced something 2 or 3 years ago now, and I didn't sleep for days, Tim, because what nature said was, when you combine challenge to the stimulation of the vestibular system with a challenge to the cerebellum, you multiply stem cells in the cerebellum.
Wow.
So you can imagine when I read that, I almost fell over. I certainly didn't sleep for a couple of days because it was so exciting. You know, we'd been working away and hoping we were creating plasticity. But when they produced this, it was actually work done on mice. But what works on mice generally works on humans. And they proved this. So one of the things we want to do in the future is set about showing, taking pictures of this actually happening in humans. You know, people pay fortunes to suck out stem cells from certain parts of their body and re-inject it into other parts. And that's fine if it gives you more youth, more whatever. But you imagine naturally multiplying stem cells in the most critical part of the brain. It's an awesome. So suddenly, all of the amazing results we'd been getting during the years of research, and they are amazing results. Suddenly, we'd got something that explained why it was happening to such a remarkable extent.
Amazing. And as we know, the stem cells can become like their environment. So if you put stem cells in an elbow, they become better elbow parts. If you put them in an eyeball, they become better eyeball parts. And so if you develop the exercises you have, if it's actually stimulating stem cell production in the cerebellum, it can become whatever it needs to be in the cerebellum to improve cerebellum functioning.
That also was mentioned in the research, is that you have to maintain this vestibular stimulation challenge to the cerebellum for about 6 weeks before those stem cells become vital new circuits in the cerebellum. Where else? You know, it's just so thrilling. And, you know, one thing we spent a couple of years working on is how long do we have to keep people doing this? So we settled on the fact that you need to do 10 minutes twice a day for 6 months to be sure of systematically going through the different parts of the cerebellum, in other words, going through the different skill sets where you have weaknesses, to make sure that you're maximizing your potential. You're finding all of the areas where you can enhance your skill performance. So had that research come out 20 years ago, it saved me an awful lot of time and money. But, you know, we got there in the end, because what happens is those first 6 weeks, you're creating plasticity, you're creating the possibility. Then you spend a few weeks turning that into improved skills. And then we want to make those lasting and long term. So we continue people for a few weeks more until we feel that they've plateaued, they've reached their potential. Isn't that potential a wonderful word? You know, people often say, oh, he's got loads of potential. They never say where it is. Well, we now know where it is. It's there in the cerebellum. We can measure how much there is. And because we've done so much work with so many tens of thousands of people, we can now actually prescribe what it is that's going to stimulate, give stem cells, give plasticity to the very areas that need beefing up.
And you mentioned at one point that you did 10 minutes twice a day, and now you realize it only needs to be once a day?
Yeah, well, it does vary, Dr. Tim, based upon the degree of symptoms. So for instance, an elite athlete that's doing a lot of training, what they discover is there's still some sensory integration that their training never does. So they're still missing out. They've still got missing links. It often doesn't take long for an elite athlete. Sometimes it's only 3 months. But then if you look, say, at someone with a significant ASD, set of ASD symptoms, autism symptoms, there's layer upon layer upon layer of skill development that's needed to get them as far as you can get them. So that is usually a longer process. So look, every single brain is different. What we've got is absolutely not one size fits all. And so we have to rely on the initial neurological tests and the daily feedback, so we're optimizing everyone's potential. And optimizing for us is maximizing the amount of gray matter we can get into the cerebellum. And then that's the natural bit of the brain that naturally develops skills. We just let it get on with its job. And the wonderful thing about the cerebellum is that the results last. You know, with the detail of what we're talking about now, if we retain it in our brain using the hippocampus, then that fades pretty consistently after days, weeks, months. But when you learn to ride a bike, it's the cerebellum that does the job of creating the process, the skill that happens in the subconscious. When you've got that, when I was 18, I bought a car, I put my bike away in the shed, I forgot about it, I loved cars. And then when I was about 40, I decided, you know what, my fitness is gone, I've got to get my bike out. And I got it out, pumped the tires up. All those skills were still there. Absolutely, because that's what the cerebellum does. So when you can develop the cerebellum in the way I'm describing, the results seem to last.
Wonderful. Well, so at what age, is there an age where you're too old to benefit from the kinds of exercises that you're...
When we started this, we were working on children. We put a cutoff at 16. Then, of course, a mum of a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old came along and said, look, my child's tried everything. He or she is still struggling. And we discovered, yeah, it did work. And then we got folk in their 20s and 30s. And I was giving a talk in England one day in a place called Southampton. And a lady of 82 came up to me afterwards, sprightly lady. And she said, I want to read and write before I die. She could see me going backwards. And I said, you know, and she stopped me. She said, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say I might hurt myself because these are sort of exercises. She said, but let me tell you, I am hurt more every day because I can't do what everyone else finds easy. Please let me do them. 4 months later, her name was Liz. Liz was on national TV, national BBC TV, holding up the first letter she'd written in her life to her sister and reading it out. And suddenly we realized, you know what? And the research supports that, of course, now. Plasticity can happen at any age if you do the right things. So there is... As far as we know, there's no upper age limit. You have to be able to do some simple exercise. You don't have to be able to bounce and jump around, but you have to be able to do some simple movement and coordination. And to call them exercises is Sounds like it's hard work, sounds like it's boring. No, these are stimulating plasticity. So they're more about challenging brain with simple movements and balance things. So there's no upper limit. There is a lower limit. Cerebellum is actually developing rapidly until the age of 7. So we've not found it worthwhile until someone's past their 7th birthday.
So what does the process look like? How does somebody who's, what would somebody be looking for if I was the parent of a 14-year-old who was seriously struggling in school and I know that he or she is intelligent, I get on the website at Zing Performance and I'm across the ocean from you. What can happen?
Well, look, this is an online process. You know, we've worked very hard for many years now, making it safe and reliable and effective online. So we have coaches. We have coaches and now, of course, come on Zoom to support you because that's critically important. But the process of neurological testing can all be done online. Actually use some neurological tests. They've been around for tens of years and widely used by different universities. And we've built those into what look like fun games. We're actually very carefully measuring mental capacities and where there is potential for further progress. So that's a 30-minute process that everyone does before the start. And then you're given daily exercises that get delivered on your smartphone through an app, and they show you precisely what to do. That app gives you feedback. We get feedback from you from that app, and we automatically adjust the exercises, the level of stimulation, the type of challenge, so the next day you're doing something different. And that carries on and carries on. Every month you do another neurological test with subjective feedback as well. So every month you're getting graphs of where did I start neurologically? What was I saying about subjectively about the various symptoms of my child? And then every month you redo that and you can see for yourself. And the wonderful thing is there's usually pretty strong correlation between practical progress in everyday life, in schoolwork and so on, and the neurological progress. And you touched on it. You said it a few minutes ago, a child that's intelligent. Many children who have these symptoms, Dr. Tim, they're not regarded as intelligent. You know, if you don't read and write easily, if you can't pay attention easily, you're actually not being able to take in much information. And when you're in an exam, you can't give out much information. So that's interpreted as low intelligence. But the irony is, the greater the underlying intelligence, potential intelligence that's there, the more likely it is that they're going to have some form of issue with reading, writing, listening, comprehension, spelling, all of those issues commonly found. So, you know, I've not met many billionaires, but I've met a few. None of them read for pleasure that I've come across. Why? Because reading is hard work. But are they intelligent? Wow. Do they do well at school? No, nearly all of them dropped out. No. There aren't many billionaires compared to how many there are folks struggling. So I'm not suggesting if your child is struggling, assume he or she is going to become a billionaire. It doesn't kind of work like that. For every billionaire, there's at least another 10,000 people who are struggling underachieving the whole of their lives. So, but the point is that these issues are not a sign of low intelligence. They're a sign of mental stress. And the research now shows that the probability is that children with these issues go on in later life to develop mental health issues, more than 50% of them. That means we've got to not just think about their school results, we've got to think about their life in considering these symptoms. So, you know, what we're talking about is the role of the cerebellum explains the amount of mental capacity we have, and we can measure that, and that explains the amount of mental robustness we have or not, as the case may be. And the wonderful thing is, if you develop the cerebellum, you improve the skills, you increase the working memory capacity because you're reducing the need for conscious compensation, and you're giving someone mental robustness, mental resilience. Now, I know this goes against the grain a bit of what a lot of people think. Forgive the pun, but we've been brainwashed to think that the expression mental health is all about problems. Physical health is all about strength and fitness, but mental health is all about problems. That's brainwashing. We should start thinking about mental health as the pursuit of what's going to give me mental robustness, get me a long way away from anxiety, a long way away from overwhelm, get me to a point where I'm feeling on top, where I've got mental capacity to deal with everything that life throws at me. So mental health to me is a positive concept because now we know what we can do to pursue it.
Wonderful. I keep coming back to, you were talking about the autism spectrum, and I know that it's such a widespread issue. More and more we're seeing it at various levels. What are the factors that you think this increased robustness of the cerebellum is doing to alleviate some of the symptoms that people have, of struggles people have when they're on the spectrum?
Let's quickly go over some of the key struggles that they have on the spectrum. Reading is an issue for some, but absolutely not for others. Listening is a problem for many, but not all. Physical coordination is for some, but not all. Social skills is one of the very common ones. So the ability to look someone in the eye, read their body language, is a skill that needs to be developed by the cerebellum. But if it's not, it ain't. Ability for change, coping with change, is very often an issue. Well, what gives us the ability to cope with change? It's the cerebellum. So what change means, I've got a set of sensory inputs happening that I'm not familiar with. And when the brain's not familiar with something, it gets stressed. Why? Because the thinking brain has to work hard. Normally, if the cerebellum is doing its job, every time you get a repeat of a new combination of sensory inputs, the cerebellum turns that into a program so that you automatically deal with it. You can cope with it without having to think. But if the cerebellum's not doing its job, then those new situations, in other words, those new combinations of sensory inputs, are not getting automatized, and they always stress me. So whichever of the characteristics of ASD you look at, you can turn to the cerebellum and work out what's happening. It's either the cerebellum directly, or because the cerebellum is not developed some key skills, you get this overload in your prefrontal cortex. Your executive functions aren't happening properly. So impulsivity can happen, OCD can happen, and a poor attention can happen, lack of emotional control can happen. So all of the things that should be controlled here don't get controlled, but the problem starts at the back because it's not developing the key skills to make every aspect of life easy and effortless.
Got it. And yeah, it's great. And as you were going through that, you know, because anybody who deals with people who are on the spectrum at any level knows that anxiety and these obsessive compulsive traits are a big part of it for most people. And you hit those as you were just talking. So what's the availability? What's the accessibility? What's the cost of a program like this?
Oh, I didn't know you're going to ask me questions like that. I'm here to explain the science, not to sell the program. So I probably say something wrong and get into trouble for this. But in America, Dr. Tim, I think the price is $147 per month for 12 months. That comes with all the coaching. It actually comes with a money-back guarantee. So if we don't make progress, you don't have to pay. As you can tell, I'm always a little bit uncomfortable about talking about money. I want the government to pay for this ultimately. We're not there. We're a long way off that. But for families who, the kind of money I see spent scares me. So I'm just trying to cover our costs here and reach as many families as we can. So we've made it as affordable as we possibly can. So I'm pretty sure the price is $147 a month for 12 months.
Okay, well, that's fine. We won't hold you to it. And that gives us a ballpark figure. So we know we're not talking about, you know, $1,000 a month. Well, I have people that I deal with who have serious troubles, and they've got 14-year-olds and 17-year-olds where they're already spending a couple $1,000s a month. Mm. Or the one thing that they think might help them would cost a couple $1,000s a month, and they can't even come close to affording it. So that gives us plenty of good information.
The big difference is this, Tim. When you're using something that effectively is a coping strategy, you have to use enough coping strategies to deal with all of the symptoms. What we're working on is the root cause of the symptoms. And when you deal with the root cause, and there's a natural bit of the brain that naturally can finish off the job, if you drive the plasticity and create the stem cells, so that the cerebellum, the natural bit that hardwires the brain up to do all of the things properly that it should, that are missing right now, work on that. You know, imagine if you got a puncture in your car and you only had a roll of sellotape and you tried to sellotape up the whole tire, probably wouldn't be very effective. But if you repair the puncture, the one hole, it's a far better way of solving the problem. So my focus has always been let's get to the root cause, deal with that, and everything else clicks into place. I mean, we often get complaints from people, and these are the complaints. We laugh at them, of course. You never told me this was going to happen as well, and this was going to come right, but you never told us that was a problem. And then it's whatever they're saying has improved. You can explain back to, okay, it's because your working memory capacity has gone up. So confidence goes up. You know, confidence is low when you've got lack of automaticity. When you're having to think about something, your confidence is right down there. So just by increasing automaticity, you reduce the need or remove the need sometimes for any conscious compensation. Self-confidence goes up. We had the most amazing situation. The very first study we did, two professors in a school, we did 30 children, all of whom were reading below average. After a year, they were all reading at or above average, and the headmaster and the parents and the kids were thrilled. We had a five-year reunion where the professors were there, and into the room walked 30 confident young men and young women. Everybody's jaws dropped because they were all happy and confident. Some of them had gone on to become national athletes, but operating at the highest. They couldn't clap their hands, some of them, before. Their physical coordination had become so perfect. Many of them had gone on to university. I couldn't read or write at the time we did it, but it was their confidence, their ability to converse happily and comfortably with these professors. They were so on top. And why were they on top? Because their cerebellum was finishing the job of making all the things they do every day in life much easier than it ever was before. So confidence, you see, and we often get told, you didn't tell us about confidence. Well, we don't want to overpromise. All we're going to promise is we'll do our best to complete as far as possible the development of the cerebellum, which is the root cause of the symptoms you've mentioned and could well be several others as well.
Wow, wonderful. I keep coming back in the thought to asking how your daughter is.
My daughter is alive and happy to this day. And as a dad, that's all you could want. Her health, not her mental health, but her physical health has troubled her a bit in the last few years. You know, she was 28 when I managed to reach her with this, and she had pretty profound issues. You know, I always like to reach children at school, but it works just as well on adults as well. Or, you know, there is no upper age limit, which is amazing. And that was one of the beautiful things about the research into plasticity. The fact that you can achieve it at any age is kind of thrilling.
Wonderful. Well, how long ago did this become available in an app form?
Well, we started work on this as an app about 9 years ago, but there are some aspects of it. We've had to wait for the technology to catch up with what we wanted to do online. We've got eye tracking, which is best done in a clinic. So there's more and more chiropractors and naturopaths and other healthcare providers putting this into their clinics because it's a game changer. When people just see that result, it takes 12 minutes. They go, wow, that's it. You've explained it. Why has nobody shown me this before? But the program itself can then all be done online. In fact, everything can be done online except the eye tracking. And some don't bother with the eye tracking. But if they have a chance to do it, I always say go to a healthcare provider that's got the equipment and have that, because that will prove to you what the problem is. Because we don't just show eye tracking for reading. We show attention, the ability to focus. That lack of that ability shows up on this equipment, and you can just see it for yourself. Oh, wow, my child isn't choosing not to focus. My child has a problem with focus and attention. So that kit is good. But so whether or not you can get to a healthcare provider that's got that kit, you can do it. It's all online. It's robust, reliable. It's fast. Is it as fast as taking a pill? No, it's not. If you want to take a pill, then by all means, take a pill. But just remember, you're not dealing with the root cause. You're trying to put a sticking plaster over something that isn't going to go away. And look, I'm not against meds. There are some folk can't survive without meds. They need it just to cope with tomorrow and today. And I get that. But if you're going down that track, also look at what is the real reason, the real root cause of this, and have a look at what I'm sharing with you. I think it's the most exciting thing I've come across that can impact such a huge proportion of mankind.
I like to stop. We're very close to the end of our time here. And I like to ask people, what's an aspect of this, perhaps, or your work or book about this that we haven't even mentioned yet?
I wrote this book a couple of years ago, and it goes through every one of the symptoms and explains in detail neurologically what the cause of it is. It's on Amazon. In fact, it went to number one in its category the day it got published. So you can get it on Amazon in America or Britain or Australia, I believe.
Okay, so Stop Struggling in School. You held it up beautifully so the people that are watching the video can see it. But We didn't say the title. Stop Struggling in School by Winford Dore, D-O-R-E. Wonderful.
And there's a lot of research references in there. If you know, doctors and other medics that are listening, they'll be scratching their head saying, why haven't I heard about this? Well, have a look at that, because that's got a lot of research references in explaining exactly everything I've said. I'm not in this to make millions. I've never taken a penny out of it in over 20 years of research. I put everything in, my time, my money, my initiative, because I don't want other families to go through what my family went through. Lots do. You know, COVID has doubled the number of children at school committing suicide. What's that an issue of? Well, it's an issue of them not having enough mental strength, of having enough problems in life to make life hard work. They're misunderstood. You know, when people assume that a child is choosing not to concentrate, when in actual fact, they can't concentrate. When they assume they're choosing to be disorganized. No, if you've got very little mental capacity, you can't be organized. You are going to forget your homework and your equipment for sports that you've left at home again. You know, all of these things aren't choices. But when children are misunderstood, all we are doing is multiplying the trauma that they're already experiencing. And by doing that, we're increasing the stress, the anxiety, the load on their brain that is going to show up, if we're not careful, as mental health issues later in life. So I'm a board member of the REACH Institute in New York, and that's led by the former head of child psychiatry for the National Institute of Mental Health. You know, it's a wonderful group of people. And all the time we're being given the data about what's going on with mental health in children. And what isn't understood is this overlap between learning struggles and mental health. What's not being talked about is what happens later in life and the probability that a child that's struggling in school is going to suffer some serious mental health issues. Well, you know, we can't bury our head in the sand about this. You know, 3/4 of American counties do not have a single child psychiatrist. And that in the last 2 years, the number of children struggling has doubled. The number of people committing suicide has gone up by a similar amount. And there's no resources there to help them. So the healthcare providers that exist, pediatricians have got to do more. Teachers have got to be more alert about looking for the symptoms. So if there's any symptom of mental health at all, plus a learning difficulty, then that multiplies your concern about that child, because you know statistically what's going to happen down the line.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us. It's Zing, Z-I-N-G, performance.com is the website. And the title of the book again, just say it, please. Stop Struggling in School.
Stop Struggling in School by Winford Dore, D-O-R-E.
Wonderful.
It's on Amazon, and there's an awful lot of useful information in there. And I just want every parent to become a warrior parent. Don't assume that the health authorities or the education authorities are going to pick up on this. They don't have the tools. They don't have the resources, which is why my wonderful team has worked so hard to bring the tools and resources to every healthcare provider that wants it, to add it to their repertoire of services they offer, to every school that wants it, but into every family's home that wants it as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's a delight to finally meet you face to face. And I'm going to follow the work, and I think I'm going to get on the program. And then I'll have you back and we'll talk about my results.
Dr. Tim, I look forward to that. I'm throwing down the gauntlet to you now, saying, okay, you rise to the challenge and see what happens. 10 minutes a day for the next few months. And I'm looking forward to what you discover.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again. Blessings.
Thank you.
Winford Dore is the founder and CEO of Zing Performance. Winford is a successful entrepreneur and has been the founder of many successful companies and the creator of countless forward-looking innovative solutions. For the last 20 years, Winford has focused his attention on changing the world one brain at a time through Zing Performance. Winford funds many research projects and works with leading academics to determine the best solutions that successfully accelerate learning in the brain. Through Winford's dedication, Zing Performance now has the tools, scientific research, and strategy to achieve the results that every parent and child wants to see. Not stopping there, Winford hopes Zing Performance can help as many people as possible and will provide the successful results and feedback that can transform government policy on education. Zing's mission is to deliver life-changing transformations in learning and development to as many people as possible through science-backed tools, programs, and services. I am pleased to announce that I will be participating in the upcoming Integrative Mental Health Summit. I'm honored to be speaking alongside 35 of the most innovative thought leaders and practitioners in the mental health field today. The three-day virtual event will take place October 8th through 10th, 2021. It is sure to be packed with inspiration, education, tools, and support. You can get your pass today to attend the entire summit for a minimum donation of only $25 at integrativementalhealthsummit.org. That's integrativementalhealthsummit, all one word, .org. Please join us for this fabulous event and share this information with anybody that you think might benefit.
You've been listening to the On Your Mind podcast, offered by Journey's Dream, where we support people through mental health challenges to a place of true and lasting well-being. If you love our show, we invite you to visit onyourmindpodcast.org to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover our helpful resources. Thank you for listening.